Everyone, welcome to episode 62 of The Hard Truth About B2B E-commerce. I'm Timothy Peterson, and my co-host is Isaiah Bollinger. Hello, Isaiah.
Hey, Tim. It's good to see you after the Christmas holiday. For those that celebrate and for those that don't, happy holidays.
Well, thank you. You too, and happy almost 2022.
Yeah. We're about to be at our next holiday, New Year's.
Our first sponsor is PunchOut2Go. PunchOut2Go is a global B2B integration company specializing in connecting commerce business platforms with e-procurement and ERP applications. PunchOut2Go's iPaaS technology seamlessly links business applications to automate the flow of purchasing data. With their solution, you can immediately reduce integration complexities for PunchOut catalogs, electronic purchase orders, invoices, and other B2B sales order automation documents in order to accelerate business results. Balance is our other sponsor. Balance is a B2B e-commerce payment solution that works well for you and your buyers. It offers a seamless one-click checkout for almost any payment method, including ACH, wire, checks, cards, even terms. It's used by leaders in B2B e-commerce, and it's as easy as buying a shirt from Amazon. Check them out at getbalance.com, book a session, and tell them what your needs are. They are the first dedicated payment platform for B2B e-commerce, 100% tailored to your needs. Thanks again to our sponsor, Balance.
But we're really excited about our guest, Mark Donegan, who has 20 plus years of technology, marketing, sales experience, kind of all over the map. And what I think is super interesting about your background is you have kind of that technical background, but also, you know, now more and more in the marketing side of things, especially in B2B. And you've really seen that intersection between technology and marketing and sales. And that's a lot of what I want to talk to, because to be honest, I think that's where a lot of these companies that we're trying to help with this podcast struggle. So please give people a little bit more information about your background, because you've done so many things that I don't want to highlight the wrong thing.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's great to be here. Always love talking about marketing, but really I like talking about business, you know. And so I'll get to kind of my background, how I got to where I am today. But I just believe that the greatest place to be right now, if you really want to have an impact in really any company, you know, regardless of the industry, the sector, is in marketing, because the strategies that get deployed and the tactics that are available to us can be transformational to a business. And, you know, certainly you need execution on the product side, on the engineering, you know, on sales, on revenue. So it's not to say that, you know, the entire company is really only going to be driven by marketing, but, it's just a great place to be. So I'm really happy to talk about it. So my background started in sales. I didn't end up finishing my computer science degree, but when I was 12, I discovered my school's Apple II and learned BASIC and, you know, kind of just dove into this whole world. I guess today, you know, I would have been a hacker if I was a teenager today, but had, you know, just really loved it. Ended up going into a computer science program, dropped out and went to music school because I wanted to be a rock star. So,
and so did you become a rock star? I want to make sure I understand that.
I never became a rock star. Now that's exactly why I'm sitting here today. Otherwise I might be on a different podcast. You know, maybe I'd be on Joe Rogan's show or something.
I just wanted to make sure, you know, in case.
No. I, so, So, yeah, so, you know, so along the way, in fact, in music school, I observed, I went to a school, you know, with some just really fabulous players and yet these guys were all like, you know, nothing wrong with working at McDonald's or driving a school bus, but they were working at McDonald's and driving a school bus. And from my point of reference, like these guys are like world-class players and, you know, and basically they're the epitome of poor starving musicians. So I said, I don't want to be that. And if they can't make it, you know, so
yeah, these are like really talented people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like, you know, like I could hang with them, but you know, in an audition, they would beat me every time. So it was like, okay. So, you know, but, you know, life is interesting because I, you know, I guess at the time, you know, I didn't really know anything about, I hadn't really studied psychology and I didn't understand, you know, the left and the right side of the brains and how they interrelate and how, but, you know, the reality is that I am, I function very well left and right side. So I have the logical and I have the creative. And so I went into sales. I can make money and I enjoyed that. And did really well and began to, you know, grow into managing teams and that sort of thing. And along the way, I just really by necessity found that I was taking control of marketing, you know, initially for me as an individual contributor. And then, you know, eventually it's kind of like I had marketing resources matrixed into me, you know, for my sales team, et cetera. Probably about, I guess, 10 years into the sales journey, I again, you know, you stumble upon and you just realize like, wow, when you get involved in the strategy side of the business, like, okay, it's one thing to go out and win the deal and that's great. And that's important, but you know, it's one and done, right? So you close that big deal, but what have you done for me lately? You know?
Yeah.
And, but when you're getting involved in the strategy and you're thinking about go to market and you're, you know, all of a sudden, like the decisions that are made and the structures you build and the approaches, you know, that you spearhead can be transformational to the company. And so that then set me on this whole journey to, really go more into corporate development and then eventually really own, you know, it kind of, you know, I guess you'd say like the CMO or, you know, at the head of marketing level. And so that's where I've been for the last, well, really solid more than 15 years is just really focused at the intersection. I like to call myself a revenue driven marketer. But you know, I'm always at the seat of the table with a strategy hat on, with a marketing hat. So how do we execute great marketing in a B2B context? And then there is always a revenue motivation behind just every, I can't, you know, for me, you know, like quote unquote brand, often set in the context like, oh, it's a branding exercise. Oh, hey, we went to that show. Yeah, we didn't get any leads, but it was great for our brand. It's like, I can't even comprehend that line of thinking. now, what I'm not saying is that the brand isn't important. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that when you execute properly, you do build brand, but you know, there is sometimes in some, especially more corporate marketing environments, you know, like, yeah, we're doing this thing. We spent money over here. Nothing really came of it, but it was great for our brand. It's like in today's world,
I think part of what you're saying that I can relate to and our listeners can probably relate to is that there is a long-term revenue component, you know, and that's probably what some people are saying when they're saying, oh, it's about brand. Like there's something long-term that's happening there. But you always have to have the shorter term, you know, revenue component, you know, in mind. You know, what are we making money on today?
Yeah.
You know, what's happening today? Where are the customers coming from today?
I think where you're getting at is a lot of times they're spending way too much money on those things, right? And that the ROI isn't there. But
exactly.
Here's just, you know, I'm just curious to hear your thought, but like, you know, I post a lot on LinkedIn. It's hard to measure the value of a LinkedIn profile. How do you feel? I mean, I guess with that perspective, I'm not spending a lot of money, so it's probably a decent amount.
Well,
like how do you view that kind of stuff? Where,
yeah. So, So this is awesome. I love this because and I believe your audience is also fully invested in B2B. So B2C works different, of course, but I've spent my whole career in B2B. And the massive transformation that's happened in B2B is that the buying journey has moved from, this started about 10 years ago, this shift that I'm about to describe. And these things fade over time. So it's not like a light switch. You know, it's not like, hey, 1 year people were buying this certain way and the next year, all of a sudden it changed. But the buying behavior moved from what we typically looked at as a funnel. And, you know, if you think about the whole funnel concept, that was a way for MarTech vendors to position their tools, to get people to understand, you know, okay, here's where our solution fits in to your marketing stack or into your, you know, into your particular sales process. But it largely held up. You know, buyers had to discover products in a handful of specific ways. And then there was kind of a journey that they flowed through. And, you know, industries were different and, you know, so it changed. But generally, there was a funnel. Nowadays, there is no funnel. There absolutely is no funnel. The buying journey is absolutely completely fragmented. And it's because more of the discovery process is happening outside of just the traditional like trade show, webinar. We can rattle off the 3 or 4 or 5 primary mechanisms that we used to be able to use, say 10 years ago, where that kind of was, you know, I go back 20 years ago, like I come out of the consumer electronics industry. And so like CES, just as an example, the Consumer Electronics Show was a show that you literally had to be at. Mm-hmm. If you weren't there, if you missed a year, you literally missed out. I mean, sure, after the fact, you could read about it in an industry journal or you could have a sales rep come tell you about, you know, something. But you had to be there. You needed to meet with the manufacturer. You had to be there. Well, now there is no reason to go to a trade show. There's all of the manufacturers are introducing all their solutions and products ahead of time. It's all freely available. They're setting up meetings with their key customers beforehand. And so what's happening is the buyer's journey is just, you know, it's moved from this very clean funnel where you could kind of say, hey, we're doing this particular marketing tactic, or, you know, we're spending money in this area because we know that we're going to hit people, you know, who are at this stage of the buying process. Now, getting back to your question about LinkedIn and just I'll more broadly unattributable marketing efforts, because that's really what we're talking about. Because when you put a post up on LinkedIn, you can say, oh, wow, this one got, you know, 435 views, at least according to what LinkedIn says. And usually on average, I get 300. Wow, this one did really good. But at the end of the day, like,
what's the value of that?
You can't, maybe someone will say, hey, you know, Isaiah, by the way, great post. Hey, I want to talk to you about, you know, what you guys do. And
sometimes it doesn't happen, but that's not like average.
It's not. Yeah. So what we're talking about is unattributable things. And what I'm describing here in the buyer's journey being just completely blown up from the way it worked 10, 12, 15, 20 years ago is that if we are not doing unattributable marketing, it's guaranteed that we are not going to hit buyers at some stage where they are, because the buyers are now fully in control of the discovery process. And I'm now describing more like 20 years ago, but 20 years ago, especially in enterprise, you know, which then we called it more enterprise and B2B, but it's the same, right? The seller, the vendor was in control. Like if you worked for Cisco, you know, or you worked for Dell and you were introducing, you know, some significant new networking product and you called up a major customer, they were happy to hear from you, because they needed you to come in and talk to them about it and answer questions. And, you know, so if you were a Cisco salesperson back then, you know, like not to say it was easier, but you know, had its own challenges, right? But like, they were happy to see you. Now you call up and, you know, they won't even answer the call, right? Because they're like, why do I need you? You know, we've already gone out, we've surveyed the market, we've looked at, we'll call you when we're ready. You know,
I think part of what, you know, I've seen, and this is true also for B2C and B2B for parts of this conversation, the funnel has been exploded. It doesn't really exist as it used to. I completely agree with that, you know, assessment. I also think that it everything is happening at once. I mean, people call this different things, but it really is like there's a simultaneity, right? There's content that's being created and consumed all the time. There are communities being built all the time around that content, and there's commerce that happens all the time, and then they intersect, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really figuring out for your business what that means, but it's all of those different nodes, you know, if we want to get all like, you know, funky about it. Mm-hmm. It's no longer like engagement, you know, that's and then right. down we go.
I mean, I think
so. I wish it were. But.
Yeah. Really about building, being as many places as you can where they're researching, right? So a little bit of LinkedIn, a little, like the way that we approach is a little bit of LinkedIn, a little bit of YouTube, a little bit of Twitter, even a little bit of Instagram. Like obviously SEO is huge for us, you know, Google. I wish we had more money for paid ads, but if we had more money, we'd probably do more paid ads, right? Like, so, you know, it's just being in all these places. And then, you know, we even do a little bit of strategic, you know, to your point, trade shows or events, partnership, like partners, and then referral. Like, it's hard to create referrals, right? But you just network and you talk to as many people as you can. Like, you is a new, you know, new relationship we have.
That's right.
You remember us because we're the guys that are the best at XYZ or, you know.
Well, think about the algorithm, you know. So, okay, so we're recording this podcast. I have a certain, you know, I'll use the word audience, not because, you know, I'm not an influencer, but what I mean by that, we all have audiences because that's the network of people that we're connected to. And let's just keep this for ease based on LinkedIn, you know. So we all have our networks, all of our first degree connections, right? And the algorithm on LinkedIn is always, you know, showing. And, you know, so if I like something, you know, that's going to show up somehow to somebody in my network or whatever. The point is, we do this podcast. Odds are that most of my network has no idea who you are, what you do, that you even exist, right? And yet we're going to publish this at some point. We're probably going to publish it in different forms. You know, I'll post it, you'll post it, whatever. And all of a sudden now somebody's exposed to that who literally it would have been impossible for you to even know they existed. You know, so it's not like, well, we would eventually gotten to that person. Probably not, you know, just because
not with our ad budget.
Well, but again, getting back to what we said earlier on, like, is that even where you'd want to be spending, you know, even if you said, hey, I've got $75,000 a month to spend on LinkedIn advertising, like, is that where you should, is that what you should be doing?
Yeah.
And so this is what I like to think of. And this is not an original term. This came up, you know, someone else developed it, but I love the description. It's called dark social. And this person's concept is that dark social is all of the interactions that happen between peers and buyers, potential buyers, even vendors to a certain extent, but it's really not about the vendors. It's about the buyers that is untrackable. So, you know, a great example, I'm in a marketing group called Peak Community, and it's, you know, primarily CMOs and marketing leaders who, you know, we're all striving to become 1% better every day is kind of the mantra. Really, really awesome, you know, world-class group. Well, inside that group, every day there's conversations about, hey, you know, what tool are you using here? Hey, what are you, well, none of that's attributable. None of those vendors are in there. Nobody even knows their brand's being talked about. And yet I just know by the nature that I have contributed to discussions around CRM and marketing automation platforms where people said, wow, I'm going to make sure that I go get a demo of that before we pull the trigger on this other thing. Now, I have no idea if they bought, but you know what? that's like, that's how B2B decisions are being driven today, by and large.
Well, they will, yeah. I think they will get attributed. They'll get incorrectly attributed. So that guy goes and does a demo because he Googles them and they're like, it's SEO.
It's SEO.
SEO is killing it. And it's like,
You're bang on. And it's like, no, it came from some guy in a community, you know, or, you know, a collection of people that, you know, eventually you keep hearing the same brand or the same enough. And you're like, okay, I definitely need to check these people out. You know,
I think what you've just pointed out though, is how things have matured with sort of the influencer / creator community and how people attribute, because the communities that they create, now you attribute to them when something happens, right? Yeah. And so when you're talking about peak and what occurs there, it's an influencer creator community essentially, and you know, to borrow from B2C, really, about how you're attributing these things now. So it doesn't need to be one to one. It could be one to many, or one to group, or one to community.
Well, that's what I think. There's a guy, Chris Walker, who's done a great job.
Chris Walker is the one that coined the dark social.
Yeah,
that's who I was referencing.
On LinkedIn, especially, and you know, and I don't necessarily think this is going to work 100%, but it's like, what's the most influential channel, right? Like, how did you hear about us? Like, it might be, you know, a lot of times it's 10 different ways, and eventually you hit the tipping point, right? Like, we had a potentially one of our biggest opportunities for a product we've been developing for 3.5 years. And it's finally getting to that tipping point where like a major opportunity came to us, and they had listened to our webinar like almost like a year ago. So it's like they had known about us for a long time, but then eventually finally got to a point where they decided they were like actually going to reach out to us and take us seriously for this product.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, that's like, right.
What do I attribute that to? Like, I don't, you know, was it the webinar? Was it like over time? Like they've probably seen us many times.
One thing too, and I'm not sure there's a term that's been coined for it yet, but there is sort of a cross-platform effect that occurs right now too, because a lot of people know influencers on LinkedIn, like Luke Matthews. Luke is wonderful. I love Luke. You know, we've met. He's great, right? But Luke is interesting because he goes back and forth across different platforms for his clients. So he's on Deeso and Discord and Entree and BizFluence and all these places that a lot of people don't know about even, right? They don't even know they exist. But what'll happen is he'll be out on Discord and people say, oh, you're the guy that I remember from, you know, from Clubhouse when you had that, you know, room a while back. Yeah. And then you're over here. So it's like the accumulative effect, you know, that you're having of all of these different platforms.
Gary Vee is like the master of that, right?
we could talk a lot about Gary. He's quite something.
Yeah. He's the same thing over and over, but it works, right?
Like, he does.
Well, he is just a content engine, you know. I mean,
he's brilliant and he's crazy, and I mean that in the nicest way. I mean, he really is. He's brilliant and crazy, because he just is like, it's do these six things, and then it's like, I can't find. I know these six things.
I love it because, you know, I love it when he puts up the videos from like literally 10, 12, you know, years ago of where he's making predictions or he's talking about what the future is going to look like. And then, you know, you watch it day to day and you're like, absolutely right. You know, it's like,
so I know, anyway. All those predictions have been amazing, but I want to get into the original, you know, topic of that technology intersection of marketing and what I see with B2B and especially is that what are they even marketing to? Like, okay, if we all agree that there's this new world where it's hard to measure everything, but people are basically searching online, going into events, networking. If they're going to your website, a lot of these B2B companies, let's exclude like the high-tech SaaS companies. Like high-tech SaaS companies, they're at the leading edge. Most of them are very good at digital marketing. Mm-hmm. But most B2B companies started before, you know, 2005. So their leadership is in their 60s or 70s or 50s. Yeah. And they are not, like, I've worked with so many companies in B2B that if you go to their website, they look like they're a 10-person company, but they're like 150, 250 company.
Yeah.
And like, if you went to their website, you're like, this looks like, you would have no idea how much money they make because it doesn't even look like a legitimate company when you go to their website.
Yeah.
So my point is, It's like they can invest all these new modern marketing, but what are they going to do? Send them to this 1990s website? Like, how do you balance that investment, right? Or do you have to get the technical first before you can do all this marketing because there's nothing to send them to?
Yeah, totally. Well, there's absolutely no doubt, and I'm going to say something super obvious that, you know, but the last 2 years has raised the profile or the need or the impact that a website can have immensely, because there was actually, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking of a company I was involved with and not too long ago, as in like like 3 years ago, we were having a little bit of a discussion of what's the real importance of our website. Now, it wasn't because we were thinking, oh, website's not important, you know, but we were just thinking in the context of a very niche market, not a lot of searches. It's not like there's, you know, a large number of potential customers who are just searching and just waiting to discover our solution. A lot of the sales process was a push into the market, not a pull. And so we were just having discussions, you know, like, well, how much do we really care, i.e. spend time over here on the website versus doing other things? Well, now, look, where's the first place someone's going to go when they hear about your company, when they have a meeting, when they read a piece of content on LinkedIn, when they discover one of the executives or the founders, the CEO's profile? They're going to go to your website, right? And so if your storefront, you know, which is kind of just the way to think about it, if your storefront is in need of repair and it's kind of scrappy and it's, you know,
the lights are off. Like, think of the old days where your sign is not working, you know, letters and it, like that's what I don't think these people realize. Like, if you try to sell me on something and if I go to your website and it looks like crap, there's almost zero chance I'm going to buy from you, no matter how good a salesperson that you are, right? Yep. Like,
A hundred percent. And so, you know, so then we have to say, well, why is that? Like, this seems so obvious, certainly to us, but, you know, even I guarantee inside those very companies, there's people who are just like almost embarrassed, you know, like, I don't, you know, like, this is our website. Like, sorry, it's, you know, it's a little old, you know? And so if all that's true, then why aren't they doing something to fix it? You know, why aren't they putting attention into it? And just too much that I find, you know, in working with companies, you know, they come to me either looking for help or is there's just there's the bias of what my personal belief is of how I behave. So I can tell you that, you know, I was working with someone not too long ago where the chairman's like, oh, I would never do. I would never, you know, we're talking about publishing on LinkedIn. Oh, I don't even pay attention to LinkedIn. I'm like, well, that's how you found me. I had no idea who you guys were. You saw stuff I was posting, you know, your CEO reached out to me. Like, I don't know what to say. Like, you know, that's why we're even working together, you know? So, but, you know, but it's just this like bias. And, in this particular example, we've moved this person along and now he's totally on board, but like, that was the first comment. It was just kind of like, wow, you know, like here you are, you're talking to a consultant that you hired to build marketing who you found via LinkedIn. You know, I had no idea who these guys were. They found my content. They reached out, you know, and then you're telling me you don't believe that LinkedIn really works? Like, what?
I'll just give you a couple asides on that too, because, you know, I've worked with B2B, B2C, retail tech, you know, all of these different angles, right? And I was speaking with somebody not too long ago, similar situation, right? And we were talking about like, well, you know, it's no longer the Mad Men era, right? Yeah. You know, back in the Mad Men era, like the CEO would come in and say, I don't like that Coca-Cola ad, right? And then all it would change and they'd have to change it. Well, that's really baloney now. I mean, that's absolutely not the way anything should ever be done.
Yeah.
You know, even if the CEO is brilliant, you know, and there are some people who are, there's no reason that would occur. Like, why wouldn't you look at the data? Why don't you understand who your customers are, where they are, what they do, and then act accordingly, right? And so that's what's astounding, is that there's still remnants of that, little pieces of that that creep through, especially in B2B.
So
it's really pretty shocking.
And I think, though, these things, these things work themselves out, because, you know, market forces are really market forces, you know. And look, reality of the matter is that you can sustain a business for a certain length of time running on, you know, very old thinking, and you can sort of keep the lights on, but it's not forever. And the market today is just way, way too competitive and dynamic. You know, I really love the word dynamic, because, you know, dynamic, you know, a competition is sort of, you know, like dog eats dog. Like, we're out there, you know, bumping up against each other, trying to win, in some markets, that's very much a reality.
Dynamic
is where, you know, it's just that the change is so profound, and we wake up every day not able to say, well, we know how the world looked yesterday, so we're 100% certain it's going to look the same today. It's like, no, we are not 100% certain. You know, all I know is I'm still alive today, you know, so that's good. I think that, you know, these things, they do work themselves out. And what I have just learned in my own, you know, even as a consultant, and just is that there are some companies that I just can't work with. You know, there's some companies I very much want to, because I know I can help them, but I just can't work with. Like, if somebody just can't, you know, in air quotes, get it, I have to move on, and I do. And so one of the secrets, just in my own, just out there working, and this is maybe a tip for, you know, even employees, if someone's listening and they're kind of frustrated, like, yeah, my company doesn't get it, go find another company to work for. You know, find a company who does get marketing, find a company who celebrates that, dynamism, you know, in the market, and is waking up every day to reinvent itself and to, you know, build bigger and build faster. And, you know, because they're out there. They are out there.
And I'm so glad you just said that. It's funny, because I was going to try and ask you a question that's almost exactly leading to what you just said, which is a couple things. One, as a vendor, I'm curious, because I do this. When someone reaches out to you, and I'm assuming you do a lot of inbound, like we do a lot of inbound. So we don't do a ton of outbound. Like, we do a little bit of, you know, strategic outreach in certain niche ways. Sure. But generally, people are coming to us from a referral or whatever it may be, our SEO. The first thing I do is I look at their website and their LinkedIn profile, company profile. Yeah. And to your point, if they don't get it, if it's a really bad, and in some cases really bad for a reason, but if it's so bad, I'm like, man, like, the amount of work we're going to have to do is so much money. And then they only have a quarter of the budget that we're going to need to really get them to the next level. It's like, they just don't get it. I'm just curious. Sure. Do you do that? It's like, I'm almost evaluating them as 100%. If they're selling me, you know?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Even though I'm selling them, but I'm kind of like the other way around, in a way. You know what I mean? And I'm
like, right.
More and more, as we get more busy and we've gotten better and better, we're just saying no, or we're just quoting what we believe, which is double what some people are willing to pay.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, I had a couple, experiences, I guess I'll call it. One was something a mentor told me, actually a founder of a company I was really privileged to be a part of that did quite well. And I'll tell you what he told me, and then just my own observation, really puts an exclamation point, I guess, on what we're saying here. But this guy's, his name is Tony. I remember he looked at me one day. We were talking about, I don't even know what the context was now, because when I think about what he told me, it's kind of like, why would he have said that? But I remember he looked at me and he said, Mark, he said, make no mistake, one of the single most important decisions that you're going to make in your career and just life is the company you work for. And now let that sink in, because on the surface, it's easy to go, oh, yeah, of course. Of course, if I were early Google, early phase, you know, it's easy to kind of just take it face value. And then we talked a bit more, and this is really what he meant. What he meant was, if you choose to spend your time, okay, you're going to get paid a salary and whatever, get a little bonus, maybe a few stock options, kind of wherever you work, you know, depending on the industry you're in. And let's even assume that it's all within a 5%, even a 10% band. Like, okay, yeah, you may make a few bucks more working over here than over here, but basically it's the same, right? So then why would you choose one company A over company B or company C over company D or whatever? Well, you know, let me tell you, if company A is really progressive and they get it in the context of what we're talking about here, and they understand that the marketing game has changed, they understand that buyer behavior has changed, and they're willing to invest, and the CEO is more concerned about business impact than about how many MQLs, you know, the marketing team has generated, you know, or some other metric that is really not correlated well the business results. Let me tell you, as a marketer or as a revenue leader or whatever your function is, you will be more successful. And you will then be able to take that experience, because the company's going to be more successful or have better odds of being successful, and parlay that into the next job and the next job and, you know, into, versus putting the exact same energy and time into company B, where you're always justifying why you're continuing to do LinkedIn, because I'm not seeing the results. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten any leads off LinkedIn. Oh, the ebook downloads are down. Oh, you know, oh, why are we going to that trade show? You know, we didn't get any leads out of that. We already knew all the people we met there.
Yeah.
Where do you want to be? You know, and so that's something that I think we're really, hitting at is.
No, I think that's also another takeaway for our listeners. I mean, I feel like the best of our episodes, our listeners have told us there's always three or four or five takeaways. And that's another good one. I really have to say thank you for that. I did want to veer off into one other topic that we had talked about before we started recording this podcast. And that has to do with the metaverse and really about
metaverse,
things that are kind of on the verge or about to happen or the next few years. So let's just talk about that for a few minutes and say, well, what should B2B, what should people be thinking about connected to the metaverse today? Like, I hear about it. I have a concept of what it is. People approach me about it. What should we be thinking about it today?
I love it. The metaverse, it is going to be a thing. I don't know when it's going to be a thing. No, I don't even know what
prediction for us.
I don't even know what this thing is going to be exactly. No, all kidding and joking aside. I think if we zoom out, there's a good framework that I like to use when something that is clearly in the future is coming into focus, and yet we don't have clarity around what that is. And the way that, getting really practical about the metaverse is that I think that there's going to be, at least early on, too many people who dismiss it. And they dismiss it because, this is 5 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years out. And well, I'm just trying to make this quarter, And so it's easy to kind of, just both the tyranny of the urgent, push it off. And then also just all the unknowns around it. And that would be a big mistake, because the metaverse is going to get here by a sequence of digital transformational shifts that happen over time, some very subtle, like won't even really be noticed. Some will be more noticeable, but they stacked upon each other bring us into this environment where one day, we're all going to wake up and say, the metaverse is here. It's real. We're living in it. We're working in it, et cetera. And so the first thing that I would encourage the listeners to make sure that they don't do, or to think really carefully about, is dismissing this just based on this, like, yeah, it's this thing, it's going to come. I've seen the movie The Matrix, maybe it 25 years, yeah, we're going to be living there. But you know what? You know, that's 25 years from now. You know, I'm just going to focus on what I'm doing today. And instead say, hey, what are those small incremental digital transformational shifts? So, you know, if we want to just try and get practical, is maybe a good place to start is this whole, in B2B anyway, there was a heavy, heavy marketing reliance around events, around physical events, around trade shows. So what is the virtualization, i.e. virtual meetings, virtual shows, you know, how is that going to transform how I interact with customers?
Yeah.
How I present my products?
Well, yeah, you know, building a booth, building a copy of your showroom.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know what? I mean, this is like really, really simplistic, but you know, if you are, let's say you have physical goods, you know, let's say that you're a manufacturer of physical products, you know, or you're a wholesaler, or, you know, you're involved somehow in distribution of physical products.
A huge percentage of the economy, people don't realize like these companies are.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Dollars you've never heard of. Most of them out there you've never heard of.
Yeah. So Mike, my question would be, where's your studio for you to be able to go online and both for social selling, both for maybe putting together some sort of a video podcast, inviting your vendors in. Like this is, and that's kind of sounds like, well, you know, there's nothing to do with the metaverse. That's just kind of like the trend of video, right? Yeah. But you should start building that now. Like, you know, that empty office that's in the back corner of the warehouse that, you know, is just filled up with junk, literally, like, you know, have one of your team members, you know, take a day, clean it all out, paint it, put some equipment in it, and make that now a place with, you know, get some nice cameras, you know, internet connectivity. I mean, like do it right. And by the way, a lot of this stuff is not expensive. You know, but it requires a little effort and it requires intention. Because if we think about the quote metaverse, all we're talking about is bridging what now is a social platform where I actually would argue, and you know, some people kind of make this argument, like we're kind of already in the metaverse. Look how much time that we spend on LinkedIn and on Facebook and on, you know, with our phones glued. So really the only difference is where the display is. You know, are we wearing the display on our head, you know, like a headset, like goggles, or do we have some other sort of display we're sitting in front of that's more immersive, or, you know, there's some environment. But at the end of the day, what's going to be required and what's the opportunity? Well, the opportunity is going to be if there's a lot of eyeballs in this particular, on this platform, in this environment, well, I'm going to want to be there. And right now I can be there by just saying, hey, I'm going to set this little space. I'm going to have all the equipment I need. We're going to be able to go in there. We can start out just doing a monthly, you know, show for our industry. Maybe showcase products,
whatever you sell, you know, then you become the digital expert of that. And I think to your point, the metaverse is essential. I think I saw a really good Twitter thread where it's like, it's basically just a point in time when most people spend most of their time somewhat digitally enabled. So it's like, for people like me, it's already kind of there. Like you said, I'm already kind of in the metaverse because I'm on Zoom a lot, watching Netflix, you know, I'm already kind of like spending most of my time digitally. Maybe not everyone is, but over time, you know, video games and all these things, majority of your time just becomes digitally influenced.
Well, yeah, and I think that part of it too is that you're enhancing the experience, the ability of what you can do. So, you know, we're doing whatever we're doing right now, and there's audio and there's video, and you know, there's a certain interactivity, but it is very different from, you know, some of the environments I've already seen, you know, in whatever stage where you're moving through a space and you're interacting with things in the space and you're able to do certain things that really mimic, you know, maybe how you would be in another environment. I know, for example, Nike is building, you know, a metaverse store, right? Yeah. And I've seen partly what that looks like. And it's clever, you know, the idea that you could already make, you know, right now I could go make a custom shoe click and have it ordered. But the difference is that I would go through every step of the process and I'd be able to shape the shoe and color it and do all these kinds of things. And for people who really want to be immersed, that's a great way to be immersed, right?
That's
so
right.
I could see a lot of this developing in interesting ways. But, you know, I'm not going to set up a shop. I think we're not going to set up one for Trellis where people come in and buy NFTs with their crypto. You know, it's not like, you know, that's that there are people have weird fantasies about what it might be.
Yeah. And that's the mistake, though. And I think that's the caution for the listener is that a lot of the conversations around, you know, the NFTs and, you know, like you say, all these kind of super exotic and a little bit unusual or weird even use cases that for the average person, they're just like, well, I don't even know what to think of that. Like, that's just bizarre. I would never do that. And they probably wouldn't. Right. But the problem is it's a little bit throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, like, so we hear that and it's like, oh yeah, it's a metaverse thing. You know, it's a bunch of fringe, you know, but no, it's not fringe. And again, you know, for those people who just start now with just these small incremental little digital transformations, and that's where I go back to just the most basic thing, like take that spare office that's being used as a storage room right now. And look, you're doing Zoom and other things anyway. So it's going to get used. You know, let's say the metaverse never comes. Well, guess what? Having a little place that you can produce videos and you can do a high quality video conference and, you know, that sort of thing is not a bad, that's a good investment. It's not very expensive. So go do that. You know, go do that. And then if you start enabling your team and, you know, depending how big the company is and what the resources are, there's probably somebody inside the company. And by the way, it's probably not someone in marketing. It's probably somebody in the product team. It might even be an engineer who's a creator at nights, you know, nights and weekends for their some hobby or something they do. And you say, hey, you know, we saw that you're doing this thing over here. You know, would you be interested in doing something for us, for the industry? And all of a sudden this person's like, and they're bringing this high quality production and they're bringing these
creative ideas. Right? Like they're the leading expert potentially.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the goals that these companies have are these guys that no one knows exists.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones working on the product or they don't barely ever talk to the customer.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can find the right people, like, and that's something we struggle with though, is just getting them to have the time to do that. I think that's enabling them to have the time finding those people that are willing.
You have to be dedicated to the the task from the perspective that management has to say, hey, we agree and we're committed to this being a good investment, you know. So yeah. And that's also why employees, generally speaking, don't take the initiative to step up, because maybe they've tried one time and either got slapped back down or they're kind of like, oh, yeah, that'd be cool if you do that. But make sure you do everything else that's on your plate. And it's kind of like, well, already overworked.
You either need to give them a raise or some sort of crazy bonus or something that's going to make it worthwhile. But if you're just like, hey, you know, now you have 20% more work.
Yeah.
Well, why would they do that for no, you know what I mean? With no extra pay or no time off or, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think you've nailed the problem there, right? It's like figuring out culturally how to, so I'd love to get into that practical advice. So what would you, aside from kind of setting up, I love the idea of setting up like a little studio. Cause you're right. I mean, everyone has extra office space. Like you can't tell me that there's any company out there, assuming that they weren't remote first.
Sure.
Probably. Yeah. And we have extra office space.
Yeah.
Like we could be doing more with video in our own office. It's something we talk about all the time. We're like, we basically just turn one of our like empty offices into a studio. Yeah. Right. Like
exactly. Only need like an 8x10 room. I mean, really like 80 square feet is all you need. And even that
camera and like the audio, this stuff is like a couple hundred bucks nowadays.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to spend like 20 grand on it.
Yeah. Some lights. And a green screen behind you, and you're done. You know,
you know, a company I know, they did a 24/7 live stream in their empty office during COVID, which I thought was amazing. It was just such a clever idea. It's like, you know what? why not? I'm going to take a look and see if a bird's going by that window, right? Yeah. It's just such a funny idea that even that can engage people.
Yeah, yeah.
So where else would you advise? Let's say a company's like, all right, we get it. Things have changed, but what do they even do? Like, do you go find Mark Donegan, or, you know, find you and hire an expert? Do you do an internal kind of like status quo check? You know, what's your advice for someone that doesn't matter where they are? Let's just say they're not the leader. Like, they're clearly not the leader. Yeah. So it's like, we have a gap. We're not the leader. We're not Facebook. We're not, you know, the leading SaaS in our category. Just most companies, right?
Most companies. Exactly. Yeah, right? Absolutely. It's a great question. And here is why so many of these, content, we used to call it or think about as like content marketing, right? But why content marketing strategies would get started and then be killed like 3 months later is because it generally wasn't because, they weren't able to produce the content or the content was so bad. You know, oftentimes content was great. You know, they either, you know, maybe they hired a firm, maybe they hired somebody, maybe the existing team, it doesn't matter how they did it. The reason why they kill it, or why it quote unquote failed, although in most cases, if they just kept doing it, it would have succeeded. But is because, you know, if you build it, they will come does not work ever in anything. So, you know, so just saying, wow, look at this amazing new podcast, you know, this amazing new video series, this amazing new whatever the content is. Well, people have to know about it. And then not only do they have to know about it, you know, they have to be exposed to it long enough to find value to say, wow, that's really good. And then refer to their friend. And so distribution is where most companies fall down. And what I would say is that the place to start is building a community. I am very, very big on this strategy. Now, let me be very explicit about what community means. I am not talking about a Facebook group. I'm not talking about even a LinkedIn group. Now, your community may have that. Okay. So again, but a lot of people hear, everybody's telling me I need to start a Facebook group for our industry. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that's the absolute worst idea. Like, why would anybody want to come to we have a Facebook group, you know, for whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, no, that's not what I mean by community is that, and you can do this around, let's talk about podcasts. Podcasts are actually super easy because as long as you're publishing on a regular cadence, now that, you know, probably needs to be more than once a month, you know, but it once a week's probably good.
We try to do once a week and, you know, we miss some weeks. Yeah.
But the point is you're regularly publishing. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, so sometimes maybe 2 weeks goes by, maybe occasionally there's 3 weeks. Sometimes, you know, you got, you know, a string of, you know, every 7-10 days you're publishing, right? The point is that you begin to build an audience. Now that audience might start out to be 100 people. Okay. So don't despise small beginnings is one of the really key takeaways here. So, and it might even be 50 people. Well, to start, it's one, you know, I mean, you just start out with one, but you know, you might grow it and it's like, geez, we're really only getting 50 to 100 downloads in our first week. You know, like, is this even worth it? Well, remember, these people are taking their precious time. Everybody's busy in the world. So, you know, so it's highly doubtful that these are people who are just so bored that, you know, so everybody's busy. So you have 100 people, let's say, who on a regular basis are taking time to consume your content. Well, by very definition, this is a community. These are people who have chosen to spend time with you for that, however long, 30 minutes of the episode, hour, you know, whatever. Maybe they don't listen to all of it, doesn't really matter, but they're choosing to come back, okay? So then you say, wow, what if we had some sort of a virtual group that we brought them into where they could discuss and share ideas, and we're kind of moderating and participating, but this is really about them, and you bring them into that. And then all of a sudden you say, hey, by the way, if you know other people who'd be interested in this, bring them in. And then you say, well, this is all really cool, but you know, we can talk about virtual all day long, but we're still humans, we're physical beings, we're, you know, so it's nice to be face to face. Hey, it turns out that, you know, we have a clumping of folks in, you know, I don't know, Chicago and Los Angeles. You know, I'm just picking random cities.
Yeah,
what if we fly in and we just rent a, you know, let's find a restaurant, you know, it's got a meeting room, you know, all decent restaurants have a meeting room that'll seat 20, 30 people. You know, we'll spend a couple grand, you know, maybe, you know, whatever, even less, depending on how extravagant you want to go. We'll invite in these folks, tell them, hey, bring along some colleagues, and we'll host a meeting. We'll do a little presentation, not a sales pitch. None of this is sales pitchy. Okay. This is all about adding value to the community. So you add value, you video it. Now you have content. Okay. Now you've got people who met you face to face. Now they're that much more like, man, these guys are the greatest. Oh, I had a great time hanging out with Isaac, you know, and everything. Everybody's happy. Right. And then you begin to build this. And all of a sudden, in a, what starts out small beginnings, like, geez, we only have 50 people listening to our podcast. Pretty soon you've got 200. But not only did you 4X it, but now you have 200 people and they're like really engaged. Like all of a sudden they're sharing content on LinkedIn. Like you're like, holy cow, I'm getting tagged from people. I have no idea who these people are. And they're saying they liked it. They're sharing it. And then pretty soon you've got 1,000. This is the silver bullet right now. Right now, this strategy works like gangbusters. But the problem is most companies won't do it, or they will stop doing it premature, too early, because they're like, we only have 50 people listening to our podcast. This isn't even worth it.
Yeah. And they haven't
bought. Where's the leads?
Yeah.
Where's the revenue? You know, like where's the attribution? Yeah. Where's the ROI?
Multi-year things. I mean, even our podcast right now, this podcast that we have, we're deep into year two, right? I think
we are.
We started around coronavirus because they're like, well, we have all this time. There's no event to go to. Yeah, sales were dead in like March and April and May. You know, it was like possible to get a sale in March or whatever, April.
Yeah.
So it was a good time to kind of start something new. So we started the podcast. And so that was about a year and a half ago.
More.
And it takes time, right? It's it also creates content, right? We have audio content, we have video content, our blog is better, our SEO gains from that.
Yeah.
We've had people reach out to us that became a partner.
Yep.
Because
we've gotten clients, partners, all kinds of things, connected to this. But one thing I'll just reference a few things that you had said that I think are kind of interesting. So I agree. First of all, I'm just going to say I agree with you and the detailed approach you were giving there, that this is something that people can do and should do. And, you know, now there's just no reason not to do these things. But what's interesting is that I think it's been an evolution. People have done versions of this in B2B, and they're certainly doing it in B2C. Because, for example, I worked with people in food and beverage and health and wellness and fashion and beauty. And depending on what those like early stage businesses or mid-sized businesses were trying to accomplish, they would do things with their communities. There was one of the wine companies. They did a party simultaneously in all 50 states, and you could check in on the video feeds in any state at any time with people sampling the same wine. And then they have content, right? So stuff like that, I think, is so engaging, so much fun, recognizes people as an individual. You know, all of these things, it's great. Businesses really haven't caught up as much as they could have. The version that I just wanted to mention is that when trade shows were still a thing, you know, before COVID, but even a few years earlier, people would have these kinds of events, you know, as satellite events off of the, like, we're in Chicago this year.
Yeah.
We're going to have a dinner on this night and go out to drink on this night. And you'd go to those and you'd have a sense of community, but then nothing happened after.
Yes, that's right.
That's the biggest issue. They were great. And then nothing happened.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so this is where then the power of the tools that we have available to us are you know, must be applied. So I'm actually really, really glad, Timothy, that you brought that up, because what I'm not talking about is like, you know, hey, okay, so, all right, so how much, you know, like, you know, how much do I need to spend? Let's go do these, you know, hey, this sounds like a great idea. All right, how much do you need? Okay, it's on the calendar, and then marketing, and goes off and does all these events. And then, well, what do we get out of it? No, this is a process. It's also not just inviting someone to come to a dinner in Chicago and then kind of like, oh, you just expect that now they're going to become a customer and it's over with. No, that might literally be the first touch. You might meet them again somewhere else. Maybe they're going to attend a few other virtual events, and maybe next year they're going to become a customer. These are investments into the future of your business. But just like savings, if we don't start saving now, you know, when you turn 50, it gets a little bit daunting, you know, to be like, you know, like, you know, I'm hoping to retire in 15, 20 years, you know, like, so.
Would you say that from your perspective, a lot of marketing and just companies fail at marketing, not because they necessarily were doing the wrong things, but because they just didn't have the patience or the mindset to think about this in a 2-3 year time span. And they're like, all right, do this thing that gets me results in a month. And then they just like fire the person. And yeah, they're constantly just, you know, jumping around to thing with no strategy, because they're not willing to wait 2 years for the podcast to mature, 2 years for the SEO to mature. Like, and you know, they just don't have, is it a lack of leadership, or you think people just have too quick horizons on, you know, these are owned by companies that have these little horizons that they want to get their ROI in a couple of years to sell the company, or like, what do you think is driving this? Just short term?
Boy, in my observation, the shared responsibility for the failure on the chief executive side and on the marketing head. Let me explain why it's shared responsibility. So, and I'll start with the marketing head. The natural thought process might be, well, yeah, of course the CMO or VP of marketing failed, so of course they should be fired. So yeah, I mean, that's like they failed, right? Well, what you just said is actually true. In a lot of cases, the execution, so, you know, the quality of the marketing campaigns, in other words, the tactics behind what they were doing in marketing was actually right and was good. You know, so you look at the website and it's actually really good. You know, you look at the messaging and wow, it's on point. You look at their comm strategy, you know, their PR, and it's kind of like, yeah, they've got that base covered fairly well. So then, but why did marketing fail? Well, marketing failed in a lot of cases, because the marketer, one of a couple things, either did not know the buyer and did not understand how the buyer actually buys. So they were executing wonderful campaigns. The problem is the buyer didn't care about the things that they were saying, or the buyer isn't in those places that they were investing in. Okay. So that becomes then the fault of the marketing leader for not being an ecosystem expert. One of the things that I learned just early on, I learned this in my sales career, and I started, I mean, when I was 20, when I was, you know, I'm like computer science and music. And yet at night I was reading Zig Ziglar, you know, the famous sales trainer. I mean, I immersed myself in the art of the sale. And I got to a point where I realized, you know what? I don't need more sales training. I already have every script down. I know every trick. I need to learn the industry. I need to learn, you know, how exactly the buyer thinks, what makes them tick, what keeps them up at night, what are they concerned about? Because at the end of the day, if I understand that, I'm not even going to need to use 90% of the tricks that I got in my bag over here.
Selling, you know, is no longer selling. It's being a consultant. If you're a good salesperson, you're the expert, you're the consultant. And And you're telling them, this is what you need, and this is why.
Absolutely.
I know, you know, enough about this that no one else can figure this out as fast as I can.
Yeah, and you'd be shocked, though. You'd be really, really, really surprised at how many, you know, very good marketers. In other words, they're good at their craft. And yet, if you try and have a conversation with them, you say, you know, even just in the most basic level, hey, what are the dynamics that are driving the industry you're in today? And you're going to get a whole bunch of high-level Gartner analyst crap and, you know, like, well, you know, 85%, you know, our customers, and you're like, no.
It's not expert level.
No, not really, you know, no, yeah. That's not it, you know. And so I said of shared responsibility. So on the marketing leader then, in some cases, not all, but some cases, the failure is just because they just didn't make it their business to become a master of the ecosystem. And if they had done that, 100%, they would have said, whoa, we're over here, you know, investing in this particular, you know, set of activities, and that's not where our buyer is, or that's where some buyers are, but not who we're going after, you know, or we think that they're buying in this manner and they are not, you know, and they would have adjusted. Now, the responsibility then, the shared responsibility on the chief executive then is that a couple things. First of all, you know, if the chief executive views marketing as this, you know, blunt tool that I just pull out and I, you know, I can quote, write a check and it's just going to happen, you know,
Yeah.
And if they are not also invested in the strategy, and if they are not engaged, if they've not hired a marketing leader who's a strategist. So, you know, I sometimes, and not because I have any, you know, I don't have an MBA. I have a real world MBA. An MBA is great, but you know what? Real life is nothing like what you learn in business school, even the best business school. You know, it's nothing like that at all. And so if someone's hiring for a classic profile, and if a chief executive is like, hey, yeah, this person, you know, they've got the classic profile. Well, you know, guess what? You got someone who's not a practitioner. And unfortunately, a lot of people who come from an academic background can present very well, very impressive. I mean, you know, hey, they're you know, McKinsey, you know, consulting, Boston Consulting Group slide presentations going to blow the board socks off. But that's definitely not a practitioner. And, you know, and today you need to hire a practitioner.
Not 2 years in the podcast, built, you know, hundreds of websites.
I mean, what I would say too, Mark, is that, you know, so like you, I've done sales, I've done marketing, I've been a CMO, I'm a COO, you know, all these kinds of different angles that you have to take. You wear your hat and you say, all right, here's my perspective. You know, this is the change perspective. But what I think really one of the things that I've learned and that you also mentioned is that it's kind of like what people used to say about silos. It's like, oh, you know, the catalog business is a silo and the retail business is a silo and this is a silo. You know, it's the same with people in the C-suite. You do not do a discrete thing that affects no one else. You know, you better all be on the same page. Right? You got to understand that the CFO next door to you is working with you and you're not working against each other. And, you know, all of these things really do matter. So the situations that I've been in recently, especially advising some startups and stuff, you know, I basically do like a timeout, you know, and say, all right, everyone hold on. You know, you seem to be talking about one thing. It has nothing to do with what's happening over here.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, unfortunate, but very common, right? Yeah. It's very common. Yeah. And so getting to that next step is like, you know, we're working together here. What's the goal? Right. What are we trying to do? Who are those customers? Yeah. How are we approaching them? Okay, great. Now we're fine. Yeah. Now let's keep moving.
Yeah, I like to talk, you know, and I think in terms of like the three-stranded, you know, cord, you know, which as the saying goes, you know, is impossible to break. And that is the CEO, the CMO, and the CRO. And I would even add a fourth strand, and that's the CFO. But if you have the CEO, the CMO, and the CRO, so the sales leader, the marketing leader, and then the chief executive, and obviously, you know, there's going to be somewhat different strategies and thinking about the business, right? But at the end of the day, if everybody is in lockstep with how they see the go-to-market, what the go-to-market strategy is, what the proper tactics are, first of all, your odds of success, I mean, you know, 10x, you know, so that's like the first advantage. But let me tell you, it's fun because now, you know, now you're not at odds. The marketing leader is not at odds with the sales leader. Yes, sure, you're going to, you know, butt up against each other at times. You know, that's just how humans are, right? But the classic, you know, marketing is always, you know, trying to sort of point the finger at sales and sales back at marketing and all that. Those are over. You don't have that. And now you're rowing in the same direction. And then when the business is building and it's growing and great things are happening, I mean, that's fun, you know, and we should all be striving for that. And I hear too many stories of people who are not in fun environments.
Yeah, they're just, you know, fighting with their own. Would you say that from your experience, and that many B2B organizations, they lean too far? I know a lot of CEOs are very sales driven, salespeople.
Yeah.
And then the sales leader. I mean, some of these B2B organizations do not have a CMO or a legitimate marketing leader, or it's some guy that became, you know, in the marketing, but he has no authority and he is so low level, not a category leader, like you said, in the industry. Yeah. You feel that a lot of these B2B companies, especially, you know, I'm not talking about the newer SaaS companies that are a little more forward-thinking. The older legacy companies, you feel like they're still too sales oriented, like traditional trade show, cold call. Is that where some of this is happening? And they just
the
CMO or doesn't even exist, or there's no one there to really, like, they don't have an equal seat at the table. So that trio is very much.
It's a good point. And the reason why I love that three stranded cord is, and it is true, you know, in a lot of companies, especially privately held, especially where, you know, the CEO is the founder and built it from the beginning and started in their garage and, you know, kind of the real traditional, you know, sort of story, right? A lot of times they are the quintessential set. They're probably, even to this day, you know, they could be a $50 million business and they're basically the chief salesperson, you know, still to this day, you know, 25 years later, and they're still out, you know, making the calls and closing.
They're the main expert. And they know the industry and they're the,
And everybody knows them, and, you know, a zebra can't change its stripes. So it's not that, like, oh, you know, stop selling and, you know, start becoming a marketer. No. I mean, but you're not going to be as strong if you have, even if that person has a really strong support person who's helping them shoulder sales. So they kind of have a sales leader. If they don't have a marketing leader there, you know what? There's the whole organization is not as strong, and there's extra stress somewhere. So, you know, it could be, you know, we're still doing the revenue, but guess what? You know, our margins are shrinking because we're not showing the market our value. And so we're only able to compete on price. And at the end of every quarter, to make our number, we're cutting deals, you know?
I mean, the way I usually kind of summarize that thought is, I say that, you know, if you're really a great CMO, you're a community builder internally as well. Right. And so you're building community. You're working on, you know, everything that needs to happen and all the groups that need to connect in the right ways to get, you know, the vision of the company to move forward. So it's not just about like where are the communities outside how do I build them? Right.
Yeah, so you're marketing internally and externally. And I'm a big proponent of being aware of that, you know, and not assuming like, oh, well, we're a small enough company. Everybody understands what we're doing. Even when you're 50 people, you know, or 40 people, like, let me tell you, not everybody understands. And when you get to 100 or 200, you know, and even bigger than that, it's most people don't actually understand what's really going on, you know, or their view or their perception, you know, of what the company even does.
Little thing. Yeah. They're in their little little cube, and they don't see the big picture. And I think we're getting to that point where almost 100 people. It's like you start to realize that getting internal alignment becomes really difficult because you got this department and that department. You can't just like do something and then you got to get everyone on board and then them to adopt a new change, and it becomes bigger and bigger once like you said, when you get to that 100 turn. Once you're in 1,000+ person, I mean, it gets even harder and harder, right? And it
This has been excellent. I think I think I speak for both of us. I wouldn't mind having you back for another episode eventually.
Let's do it.
Catching up on some other topics. It's been really great having you here on the Hard Truth about B2B.